As long as you are here and they are here, I will bow out. And if you have questions specifically of Bill, or you want to get something started, why don't we do that while we got him?
Okay. Do we close this off, Bill, when we run out of questions? That's typically how it works.
Yeah. Right. No. Knowing you and I, man, we never run out of conversation.
This is true.
This becomes the problem.
This is true. We tend to be a bit gabby.
Ah, that's right. So, do y'all have any, Peter, you got anything in mind particularly, or are you just calling in to
visit?
Well,
I'm calling in to listen. Mostly, I saw Bill Main speak at a Halsma Cisco presentation here a few years ago. I was a big fan of his. I'm a subscriber to his Trade Secrets website.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've always found that the two of you complement each other quite nicely. I know you're both seeing the same things in some ways, but you go about it a little differently.
Well, between us, we almost have a full head of hair. That's a start.
Well, Marvin's smarter, Peter, but I'm better looking.
Oh, well. Anyway, I'm looking forward to meeting you someday.
Great. Me too. Well, thank you for the Trade Secrets vote of confidence. I would be curious to hear if you have had success in implementation.
You know, I would say about 30% of the material really sparked some great conversation for us. I initially subscribed because we do a weekly manager's meeting. It was previously on Monday mornings. We just moved it to an afternoon format that's a little more comfortable. But a lot of times it would serve to generate some conversation at those meetings. I find it's a little more aimed at larger units. I mean, we're obviously just a single unit, 100 seats, and it tends to be a little more corporate, but we try to strive to that end anyway. So there's certainly a lot of gems to be picked out of it.
Great, great. Glad to hear it. That, you know, doing something like that is a labor of love. And had I known when I started where I'd end up, I'm not sure I'd have done it. But now the horse is sort of out of the barn, so I'm sort of stuck with it, kind of like a kid, you know. Once you have them, you don't unhave them.
Mm-hmm. How many subscribers do you have?
Oh, God, I guess probably about 1,000, maybe.
Wow.
Maybe.
That's great.
But, you know, interestingly, we have found a market that who utilize it a lot is the distributor sales reps.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, we buy from distributors, but these are people who have a vested interest in our success. And if they can help us, if the salesperson can help us with something more than just price and good service, because they take the time as a salesperson to utilize some of the ideas and trade secrets. I mean, it's all part of building a relationship, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I have mixed emotions about that that whole venue, though, of the sales reps becoming consultants and that kind of thing. I mean, the longer I'm in this business, the less help I want.
Right.
And the you know, I have departed from a prime vendor arrangement. And I do all my purchasing on a bid basis, and I'm really strict about it. I mean 100% across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a fan of prime vendor agreements. I think that they can be beneficial, certainly, than, you know, trying to cherry pick. But no, I don't want all those services. And I have to say that, you know, here I was introduced to you by Halsma Cisco as a courtesy thing.
Yeah.
And it was one of those extra services that they offered. And yet I would just soon pay a la carte for those kinds of things rather than going to the smorgasbord, so to speak.
Yes.
But I'm amazed that you would say that. Of course, I know Nabisco somewhat sponsored your trip up here at the same time.
Well, you have to remember that one of the most incredible parts of our industry is when you look across the country and you realize there's almost 1 million restaurants. And they're in every market is different. Every configuration of markets is different. Every group of demographics and psychographics of customers are different. That you really can't use a one-size-fits-all. What works perfectly for you, mm-hmm. and I absolutely respect what you're saying, and I agree with it. There's going to be a different guy that's going to have a different take. Say, man, this distributor takes care of me. I can't believe it. He helps me solve so many problems. I
yeah.
love Prime Vendor.
Yeah.
You know what? Value is in the eyes of the beholder.
Yeah.
So, Pete, what do you do if you don't have a Prime Vendor? You just buy with different people at different times?
Well, I'll tell you, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
You have to be really good at creating your own order guide with specific pack sizes and
mm-hmm.
Levels of quality. You have to submit it to, you know, two or three or four good solid vendors. I mean, I use Halsma, Cisco, Alliant.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to use JP. They've merged now. And a local company here in New England that's really big in the Chinese restaurants called Agar. They're heavy in commodities. But those three are the primary.
But you get better prices that way?
They submit a bid, their best price on the product, and we buy from the lowest bidder.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I never thought of that. But, yeah, it takes probably more time than what I have. But sounds like
it does take
idea.
A lot of time. It does,
yeah,
but
it would.
Depending on your volume, it can certainly be worth it, at least from my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're inclined that way, and some people love it and they'll do it well, and for some people it's a total struggle.
Mm-hmm. The thing you
there are companies that'll do it for you as well. There's a couple of people here, and actually one who I've almost delegated it to in the last month or so, at the tune of about $200 a week. But I didn't think I even had another $100 left to save, and this guy is really good at actually meeting with the vendors and saying, hey, you know, I noticed you used to get our French fry business. What's the story here? And, you know, do you have something of a little lesser quality maybe that you can compete with? And he just sort of extracts some of the pricing and really forces them to work a little harder to get a product in. Or if they've lost it, you know, discusses with them why they've lost it and goes into detail you know, with the reps so that they, you know, they are encouraged to, you know, to try another product that maybe would meet our guidelines and
mm-hmm.
things like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It just has to be enough to be able to save you more than it costs you to get him involved in it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So, Bill, what can you tell me about the portions being smaller, being the trend, about portions being smaller? Is that a fact, or am I...
I think... part of what I do is I try to study outside of the food service industry
mm-hmm.
a lot of the consumer trends. I'm a real junkie for information, and because we have so many good vehicles within the industry, from the Nation's Restaurant News to the electronic house call, so to speak, I like to get outside, and I like to see what kind of mega trends are occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big part of what I do on a consulting level. And I found that over the course of really the last 5 years, that if you look at the pure generational issues...
All right, if you want to talk to me, you can talk to me.
You with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We have, to put it in a nutshell, we have about 65 million baby boomers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the baby boom generation, of which I am a proud part,
mm-hmm.
has been the driving force behind, even though Mr. Clinton took all the credit for it, it was the baby boom generation, when they hit 42, and this is a statistical fact. If you want to read a great book,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just a great book. It's called The Roaring 2000s.
Roaring 2000?
The Roaring 2000s, and the author is Harry Dent, D-E-N-T.
Harry Dent?
Harry Dent.
Okay.
Go down to your Barnes & Noble or any place, get a copy of that book and
okay.
read it, because it's really fun, and I've used it a lot in my work. But basically what he said was that the baby boom generation, aged 55 to 39,
uh-huh.
hits their spending cycles at about age 42.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they buy houses, by washing machines.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they drive,
mm-hmm.
you know, the commodity side
mm-hmm.
of the industry, which is where good economies come from.
Right.
Selling washing machines. Well, the baby boom generation, as it gets into its 40s, another thing is happening is this huge amount of human beings that are part of that baby boom generation, as they go out and consume, and they go to our restaurants and grocery stores and they buy washing machines, as they cycle through in pure numbers, the impact on consumption and spending and sales has been positive for everybody over the last really 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as that simultaneously, there are certain biological things that happen to the baby boom generation, of which I'm a proud part. It's a lot different to be 51 than it is to be 42.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the trends that I live myself and I've seen really starting a couple of years ago is that the baby boom generation was interested and increasingly interested in more adventure, mm-hmm. indulgence, and diversity in the foods that they offer.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is a generation that grew up, we've seen it all pretty much in terms of, you know, the contemporary restaurant industry. We've seen pretty much everything. You know, we were there from the beginning with McDonald's, and we've watched everything from, you know, smoothies to Kentucky Fried Chicken. So
mm-hmm.
it isn't like there's anything really that new to us. And so we have, I think, plus when you get a little bit older, you're not interested in the volume of food
mm-hmm.
as much anymore, and you're interested in some adventure. And one of the reasons for that is, believe it or not, and this is going to sound crazy to you, as a biological fact, your taste buds are wearing out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I believe that in small plates, and appetizers and starters and side dishes,
mm-hmm.
that if we can start to slowly integrate into our menus products that have smaller portions and have a more distinct flavor profile,
uh-huh.
we can attract and hold the baby boom generation longer. And the beauty to me in small plates has always been, as a restaurateur for many years, this is where you have tremendous gross profit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, $1.50 for cream spinach with anisette cost me a quarter.
Right.
How can I miss?
Mm-hmm.
And that's been one of the real strategies, I think, that I think we're going to see continuing. We're going to see continue over the next, I think, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was building a menu from scratch now, I would have an equal amount of side dishes available
uh-huh.
as I have appetizers.
Okay.
And I put side dishes after my entrees.
Uh-huh.
Not before.
Uh-huh.
After. And then we want the waiter, waitress, or the menus to sell the idea of side dishes to share.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The social aspects of it are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And certain products, you know, certain products really lend themselves. You know, let's split an order of onion rings or cornbread or almost
right.
anything. Not big portions, but very distinct flavors.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to indulge, don't we?
Yes. Well, the young people do, too. And, we have a lot of college kids, and they do like to indulge, and they don't mind spending the money.
Yep.
And there's a lot of food left, but they want to try everything.
I think it's a tremendous opportunity
uh-huh.
for the restaurateur.
Okay.
I think it's just a tremendous opportunity, and the beauty of it to me is that if you take the side dish approach or the appetizer approach,
uh-huh.
that if you incorporate a really fun and energizing sampling protocol,
yeah,
you can build the personality
uh-huh.
of your restaurant. Now, when I was in the game, in our restaurant, we tried to almost every night that weren't busy nights,
uh-huh.
Friday night and Saturday night, we tried to make as a standard protocol that during the slower periods in the, say, dinner period,
uh-huh.
that we would sample certain side dishes or appetizers
uh-huh.
with our customers.
Mm-hmm.
You said when it was slow you did this?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, slower times you would do this or busier times?
Well, you have to, whoever's running the floor has got to make those decisions.
And you do, you sample, you side dishes, you just don't charge the customer.
Correct.
And bring it to them as a sample, and yes, we...
And you don't do it, you don't do it, it has to be handled with grace.
Uh-huh.
It has to be handled with grace.
Uh-huh.
Now you have four businessmen, and you look at those businessmen, and they're talking, and one guy's hitting a calculator, you don't want to show up.
Right.
But common sense, anybody that's in the game and in the restaurant business uh-huh. has got a sense of that. This is why I like to drive it through the floor supervisor, or ideally the owner. I did it as the owner.
Right.
Because I could do it in a half a second.
Exactly.
But if I can get 5 to 10 samples out, and then what I do is I build a little 3x5 card with the logo of my restaurant on it,
uh-huh.
and I ask them 3 simple questions. Not 10, not 1, 3. But they can handwrite a response. And I used to go to the tables and I used to say, have I got any restaurant critics at heart here? Of course, everybody laughs because everybody's a restaurant critic.
Right.
And I say, listen, you know, I've been around this place for a long time and haven't met you before, and, oh, yeah, this is our first time in, blah, 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 and you have a little repartee, as it were.
Right.
And you say, hey, listen, could you guys do me a favor? We're doing an experiment. We're trying to develop a creamed corn with Parmesan cheese.
Uh-huh.
Would you guys participate in the sampling?
Uh-huh.
What do you think they say?
Of course.
Of course. Now I've got a rapport built.
Uh-huh.
Now, the key is the sample has got to be in the 2 to 3 ounce range. Can't give uh-huh. people a lot of food.
Uh-huh.
But it's amazing how many times just touching 10 tables
uh-huh.
over a 2-hour period can build a rapport with that customer.
Right.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wants to know the owner anyway.
Right.
So
that's,
I think,
so true.
and this is one of the areas on the coming back to the distributor real quickly, is that this is one of the value adds that the distributor offers that mm-hmm. most of us don't utilize.
Yes.
And how we mix products to come up with side dishes and appetizers, distributors are never going to figure out how to do it for us. But if we ask them specific questions and can get to the specialist, you know, the center of the plate specialist or the produce mm-hmm. specialist or whatever, you can learn some really interesting things and find some unbelievably inexpensive products that you mm-hmm. can convert into high profile taste items.
Mm-hmm.
Sample them, and if 10 out of 10 people love them, then run them as a special the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, they're on the menu.
Right.
It's really important. I mean, I look at Applebee's, I look at TGI Fridays, I look at Chi-Chi's, I look at, you know, the casual dining restaurant today, and I say to myself, you know, there's another generation of restaurant in the makings right now. We call it fast casual.
Mm-hmm.
And the fast casual format is where we get the quality of food that we used to get in casual dining, but we get it for a lot less money and a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Out here in California, we got places like Baja Fresh, for example. Or where are you located?
I am in Washington,
okay.
Washington State.
Okay.
But I do travel to California quite a bit.
Well,
I know that restaurant you're mentioning.
Okay. Well, that's just one example, and I'm not a huge fan of theirs. But
mm-hmm.
the Baja Fresh approach,
mm-hmm.
which is the next generation of quick service, really,
mm-hmm.
is a pretty neat sector.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty neat opportunity. And if the casual dining, if the table service restaurant can borrow on a little of that through appetizers and side dishes and so forth, you know, there's a lot of benefits. We used to say that on a non-busy night, I'm talking about Monday through Thursday nights,
mm-hmm.
we could build a check average $1 a person across the board,
mm-hmm.
200 to 300 dinners.
Mm-hmm.
We could build it $1 a person just with side dishes and appetizers, if we use the sampling technique.
Okay. Yeah, actually, the fast casual is my competition because I'm not a fancy restaurant, but we're not fast food. We have everything fresh.
Mm-hmm.
We bake our own bread. And I see the competition with the Applebee's and those are our competition because the prices are similar and they do have a little more money for a little more advertising things. But yes. Okay. All right.
Let me just check on something for a second here, because I thought I heard somebody else come on the line. We had Peter Troutman and Sylvia Raves, and do we have anybody else on the line at this point?
Hi, this is David Troutman.
Oh, David. Oh, great.
I'm sorry. I thought I hit my mute button on.
No, that was fine. I just thought I'd heard somebody else come in, and I didn't. We were in the middle of something, and didn't want you to be sitting there unacknowledged.
Sure. Well, I'm here.
All right. Troutmans are here in force. Or did Peter Bale?
No.
Well, we're in two different locations.
Oh, good. Okay.
David's home. I'm working.
What's wrong with that picture?
I got a 6-7-year-old, so.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. She'll be fine.
So, do you have anything for Bill, or are you just hanging out?
I'm just hanging out at the moment. As I say, just stepped in, so.
Okay.
Well, what would Bill, Marvin, what would you say right now within the service area? What would you say is the single biggest mistake made in service by a, what I'll loosely call, independent casual dining operator?
Not training their staff.
Be more specific, though.
Well,
I mean, where would you see the major disconnect within the whole service cycle, just from your perspective?
From my perspective, the disconnect is that the staff doesn't listen. But the staff doesn't listen, I think, many times because the management doesn't listen.
Mm-hmm.
We get into this mode of how we want to do things, and people just charge through it. I had it happen a couple of times on this last trip where the waiter was going through the motions. They were sort of saying all the right stuff, but they weren't. I mean, we could have been a couple of cement blocks sitting there. It would have come out exactly the same.
Right.
You know, so there's no, I mean, we're losing, we're getting the mechanics, but we're losing the hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, Bill, when I have been to your roundtables or other things, you've always joked about, oh, now you're going to go back and everybody's going to say, oh, my God, here he comes. He just came back from one of those seminars.
Uh-huh.
You come back all pumped up with a bunch of ideas, and it's sort of hard to, for somebody who's really just good at running a restaurant, to get back and to eloquently sort of convey what the feeling and the excitement and the dynamics of what they've just learned or what the direction that they want to go. I know you often talk about, you know, teaching the herd what way west is. I think that's the biggest objective and the hardest obstacle to overcome is getting the excitement and sharing it with your staff in terms that they can understand.
Yeah, I can definitely appreciate that, and I don't know. I mean, I think in one regard, the excitement communicates. Sometimes it doesn't even matter what you're excited about; just the fact that you're excited about something can pump the place up. But you really you've got to work from your understanding of, I mean, I can go off and say something, but you can't go back and teach you can't go back and teach my stuff. You have to go back and teach your understanding of whatever it was that you got from whatever I said or whatever happened at a session. Because that's real. Otherwise, it's going to come across a little hollow. And people aren't going to get it.
But sometimes it's hard to give that passion to the employees because it just seems to me that they just don't get it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Well, Sylvia, this is Bill Main. You know, I agree with both points. And one additional thing I would add is, you know, when I work in a service environment, I think the thing that we as operators miss oftentimes is we can make commitments to training, but what is training?
Mm-hmm.
Training to us as baby boomers, loosely put, not that we all are, but even the Generation Xers,
mm-hmm.
if you're 35 years old or older,
mm-hmm.
and you've been in the business for a while, you have a view of what training is. But I will tell you that the average 22-year-old is light years away from our experience. As I love to say, you know, they have arrived on the scene, most of them, having grown up in homes where mom and dad weren't home. And their view of our industry is Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
By age 20, they've watched 22,000 hours of television. Mm-hmm. Imagine how hard it is with their attention span only being 8 minutes between commercials.
Mm-hmm.
How hard it is if we don't customize our training around this experience that they've had. It's fine to say teach hospitality, but I think you got to teach hospitality in the language of the person you're teaching it to.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm so strongly in favor of visuals and doing some video and lots of interactive, lots of role play, having fun, doing tests, having pop quizzes, mm-hmm. making training fun.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of short little different bites.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
And when I design training programs, specifically now, I design them so that for the trainer, the train-the-trainer part, Bill,
mm-hmm.
I say, you know, I don't want you to go, I want you to give content for 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then I want you to have something fun happen
mm-hmm.
because that person's brain is programmed.
Yes, Katie.
After 8 minutes.
I'm on the phone.
Mm-hmm. That a commercial's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, yes.
Then while the commercial's on in their brain, we got to get them involved. We got to get them somehow interactive, whether they're taking a test or watching
mm-hmm.
a video. And I use a lot of mainstream television and movies
mm-hmm.
in my training. I've got 10 different movies that I have actually copied little clips, little 30-second clips.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's out a good of. Idea.
And I don't know, have you guys seen Apollo 13?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's one of the great movies ever made, obviously, and there's a clip in there where, if you guys remember it, where Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon are there, and they're getting set to break the two spacecrafts apart. And Hanks is talking to Bacon, and they're looking at this panel, and there's 1,000 switches there. And one of the panel switches has got a little note stuck to it.
Yeah.
And Hanks says, "What's that?" And Bacon says, "Well, that's to remind me not to pull that. If I pull that, I disengage the spaceship and all of you guys go and, in effect, die." And Hanks looks at him, and for about 2 seconds, he's just silent, and he says, "Good thinking." Now, I use that little clip to say to people, you know, common sense has always got to be a key factor. If your common sense is that you should do it, you probably should.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be just walking robots and provide service that has real hospitality behind it. Well, I can show that clip in 5 minutes in a training session and say, okay, what do you all think? What do you 10 people think
mm-hmm.
is the connection here to service? And just by getting interaction, just by getting conversation, just by getting to think about it, I'm starting to affect their behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but you know what I found out, though, that the common sense is the most uncommon in dealing with some of the employees sometimes. It just amazes me how little common sense they have. So how do you, you know, it's
you
just...
You got to wring it out of them.
I guess, because it's very uncommon. I don't know why they call it common sense, but anyway.
Well, you have to understand, Sylvia, I agree totally.
Uh-huh.
But what you have to understand is that this human being that is entering the mainstream that are our employees,
uh-huh.
this human being grew up in another country.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't grow up in the same country we did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, obviously.
Right.
But all you have to do is spend 15 minutes in any of the public schools anywhere, and you know instantaneously that the public school system is not designed to create common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that, your job in training becomes teaching common sense.
Okay.
And really, it's almost an extension of what the parents should have done. The problem is mom's working every day.
Yes.
So there's this void. I like to spend the first 5 hours in training sessions with employees not even talking about the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Getting into issues like, you know, how to balance your checkbook. It amazes me, absolutely
uh-huh.
shocks me, how much information they didn't know. One of the questions that I asked in that five-hour session to the group was, who's Ronald Reagan?
Uh-huh.
And there was 17 people there.
Uh-huh.
And they were all 18 or 19 years old. Guess how many of the 17 people knew who Ronald Reagan was?
Don't tell me.
None.
Many.
None.
None?
None.
My gosh.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, this tells you how disconnected you are to
yes.
their world. And I think it underscores, Sylvia, your point.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing common about common sense.
Yes.
So if nothing else, if you approach training with what I'll call a very strategic understanding of who that human being is, you can get to the point where you can teach them hospitality a lot quicker and teach them common sense a lot quicker.
Yes.
But you just can't complain about it. You got to say, hey, look,
uh-huh.
I this is like training my dog in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that.
No, but I can understand looking at it from a different point of view. It's going to make my life a lot easier because I assume that they know things that they don't. They haven't gone to fancy places where they have the service, where they can mm-hmm. learn from role model because they haven't been there.
How old are your employees, Sylvia? Typically your entry-level people.
The servers are between 20 and 24.
Okay, just for fun, the next time that you have a small group of people that you're becoming acclimated,
uh-huh.
brand new people, ask them a bunch of questions. Pick 10 questions
uh-huh.
that any of us could answer in a heartbeat.
Uh-huh.
And ask them.
Okay.
Ask them who Ronald Reagan is.
Okay.
And I like to build a test of 10 questions.
Uh-huh.
And they're all fun questions.
Uh-huh.
They're not intended to intimidate people or trap
uh-huh.
them. It's just a fun way for you to get a perspective on who you're dealing with as an audience.
Right.
One of the questions is, who's Ben and Jerry? Now, you all know who Ben and Jerry is, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Of those 17 people, 3 knew who Ben and Jerry was, but the other 14 didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you a little something about how important it's going to be to try to sell Ben and Jerry ice cream.
Right.
So what we did was we got some Ben and Jerry's ice cream, and we had an ice cream tasting. And I got all those people involved in deciding which flavor of Ben and Jerry's ice cream they liked the best. That's all I wanted to do. I did not want to do anything else. Not how to sell it, anything else. Which flavor of Ben and Jerry's do you like the best?
Uh-huh.
Because my hope was that if they enjoyed the ice cream, picked the flavor they liked, that the next time they were at the table, they might be confident enough to say, by the way,
mm-hmm.
we got Ben and Jerry's ice cream,
mm-hmm.
and Butter Brickle is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you, Sylvia, take that simple concept and take 100 people, 100 customers are asked that question about Ben and Jerry's ice cream, you know darn well that by accident they're going to sell 10 more.
Right. Yes, I see the picture.
Got to have fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no salesmanship required.
No, sir. I think in many respects this generation shuts down when we tell them anything.
Mm-hmm.
Their answer is no. What's the question?
Right.
So if you come at it from a training perspective in teaching hospitality, as we know hospitality, before we can teach them what our definition of hospitality is, we've got to find out what their innate behaviors are, what is in their mind about hospitality, so that we can deal with how we can, you know, evolve their thinking.
How you can take examples that make sense to them
uh-huh.
to illustrate points, because we tend to use examples that make sense to us, and they may not be able to relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Disney had said, I mean, I quote this a lot, but it really was one of those profound little, as you're fond of saying, Bill, those blinding flashes of the obvious.
Yep.
When Lee Cockrell at Disney said, you can't deliver a higher level of service than you've experienced.
Exactly.
You ain't seen it, you can't do it. And we talk to these kids about service, but their idea of service is getting through the drive-up window in less than 10 minutes.
Exactly. That was my point.
You know, so we've got to find something, or we've got to take them out and show them.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you another technique that's pretty neat, and I think every time we've used it, it's just given a smashing success, is to Bill's point about you can't deliver service that you haven't experienced yourself. Imagine picking every single employee, and as part of their orientation, to actually schedule them to come in, and I'm using full service here, but to sit down at a table, and then using your superstar employees and your trainers,
mm-hmm.
deliver perfect service to them as if they were a customer,
mm-hmm.
and let them have anything they want.
Mm-hmm.
Let them experience the cycle of what perfect service looks like.
That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I want to tell you, this is for this generation.
Do you know of any operation that's doing that at all? Actually, never actually heard of that.
Well, every operation I've ever consulted with, I've told them to do it. And
mm-hmm.
I can tell you one that we did in Northern California, a company called Cattleman's.
Mm-hmm.
They got 10-unit steakhouses. And they've had, I worked with them for 3 years, and it didn't happen overnight. But once we'd cycled everybody through, we found that the receptivity of the service staff
mm-hmm.
to selling initiatives was dramatically different because
mm-hmm.
they'd experienced it.
Yes.
And to me, I just cannot imagine, Peter, being in the business today with any employee, including the dishwasher, who hadn't come in and seen what the end product of success looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Because the dishwasher wants to know that what he's doing, or she, is meaningful in the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when a dishwasher gets a table setting and he gets a plate, and this is the kind of devious thing that I would do with dishwashers, but he gets a plate that's got a little dirt on it, a little soiling, and he sees it as a customer. Now, he's in his suit, or he's in his tie, and it's not too comfortable for him, and he's there with his wife, or he's there with his girlfriend, and he sees it as a customer. All of a sudden, his job the next day of keeping plates clean has more meaning to him.
Yeah. You know, we did something similar last year in the wintertime. We had the whole kitchen staff come in and have dinner together.
Yes.
I went in the kitchen and cooked with some of the managers, and a former cook here came in and gave me a hand. And they enjoyed it because a lot of them had never experienced dining here before. But
mm-hmm.
but to do it on a structured basis with new hires, to me, sounds like it really makes a lot of sense.
Oh, it's a killer. You
yeah.
can't mess with it.
Yeah.
And if you get to Northern California, what you should do is, just for fun, go to a Cattleman's. They're all over. And don't judge whether the employees have experienced it. Just judge the overall sense of hospitality that they have. And it is because they have participated and continue to participate in hospitality as customers. They make it absolutely essential that those employees experience the Cattleman's Way, what they call the Cattleman's Way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for this generation of 21-year-olds that come to it, Sylvia, with no common sense at all, is absolutely essential.
Well, there's also, I think, a broader value in that. And I think a lot of times as we hire, so when my first job, I got a summer job washing dishes on the Cape, and they just said, you know, my interview was one question: do you know how to wash dishes? And I said, well, get back there and do it. But all I knew was, you know, the stuff comes in one side and it goes out the other side, and that was as plugged in as I was to what was going on. I think that when people see how what they do fits in, how what they do impacts on the overall experience, that it makes the job a little bit bigger, makes the job a little bit more meaningful, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
and it may help in terms of retention and you know, people who stay with us and go on to learn other jobs and maybe make a career in the industry.
Yes.
as opposed to I washed dishes one summer and, you know, now I'm painting houses.
Well, and Bill, to pick up on that point, what we're really trying to do with those types of approaches is we're trying to build a culture within the organization that these individual employees that are hourly can feed off of. Mm-hmm. And participating in it and understanding why you do what you do is as important as what it is you do.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I always laugh. I quote this all the time. You know why they call them Generation Y?
Because they're asking too many questions.
No, because every time you tell them to do something, they say, why?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
true. Yeah. Peter, are you still there?
Yes.
We've got a trade secret on this subject.
You do.
Get into your archive.
I have it right in front of me.
I think there's a tool there to help you do it. I'd really be interested if you implement it in your feedback on how it might work, because I think you might be pleasantly surprised.
Excuse me, can I say hi?
Oh, is Evan?
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit like a voyeur.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard somebody come sneaking in there.
Yeah, I was sitting here because everybody's been going so strong, I didn't want to interrupt, and I started to feel a little bit, I don't know, like a voyeur anyway.
Evan Wu from Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Edmund Wu?
That's me.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I couldn't miss out on the legendary Bill Main.
I'm standing at attention, Edmund.
Okay, you can sit down now, Eddie. How you doing, Peter?
Oh, I'm doing very well. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
And we got Sylvia on here from Olympia. And David's on. You still on, Dave? We lose
David. David had dog and child problems.
Oh, okay.
How you doing, Sylvia? I'm sorry, please carry on, guys.
Oh, you're on, Edmund.
Thanks. I do have a question. I don't know if it's proper to ask it here, but has anybody heard anything about the tips that need to be recorded from the credit cards? Something new from the IRS? Has anybody heard anything like that?
Well, we signed a track agreement.
And what is that?
You agree that you will educate your staff as to their obligation to
right.
report their tips in full on a yes. quarterly basis, and in return for that, the IRS, you fill out a form basically once a year, which you're obligated to do anyway. Most people don't know they are, but
uh-huh.
and they really just track to make sure that your cash tip recording comes close to, or at least a little closer every few months to what your charge tips percentage is.
Oh, I see.
Pretty simple.
Okay, this is the first year that we have this in Washington. And
are they knocking on your door?
No, my accountant just told me that they were required to separate the cash from the credit card tips. They want to get an idea of how much is on credit cards and how much is on cash before they just reported a certain amount. Oh, tips, you know, the tips that they made for the day. So this is new, too hard to separate them between credit cards and cash.
Isn't having a government and an IRS helpful?
in what respect? Yeah.
You know, Sylvia, to your point, and this is just an overall observation, but I've been out of the restaurant business now for 5 years as an active operator. I did it for 25 years. And when people say to me, what's the single number one thing that you miss the least? I tell them, honestly, and this is from the heart, dealing with tips.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
This, to me, has always been philosophically the scourge of our industry.
Yes.
It's particularly hard, you know, in California and Washington and Oregon when we don't have tip credits, but this becomes, for the service side, becomes the tail that wags the dog.
Right.
Everything is about them making lots of money in tips for not doing much work as opposed to delivering hospitality. And it is a part of the game that I miss the least.
You don't mean just the record-keeping aspect. You mean the just all the issues surrounding them.
The mentality.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We used to have a system, and I can't remember what the heck we called it, but it was the system that the waiters and waitresses knew that all they had to do was deliver food. You know, do 50 covers at an average of $10 a piece, do $500 in sales, and they're going to get a certain amount of money, mm-hmm. no matter what. And all they got to do is have a pulse and smile.
Uh-huh.
And we always defined that the difference between what they got for doing nothing but just being an order taker and a delivery person, mm-hmm. and what they would get by actually practicing selling, upselling tableside,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, delivering hospitality and caring about what the customer orders and making some suggestions and all that, that so many service people today don't want to go the extra mile, mm-hmm. because it's so easy to show up, mm-hmm. and not even think about the job for more than 1 second, which is why we implemented the whole pre-shift, pre-shift briefing pre-meal.
Uh-huh.
Because you've got to, before they go out on the floor, in my view, you've got to wake them up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they show up, and they've got 2 cups of coffee under them and 3 hours of sleep, and all they got to do is go through the motions, and they make money. How do we shake them out of that sort of a lethargic state to start thinking like professional salespeople?
Yeah.
We need a period of time in which we can wake them up and focus them before they talk to their first customer.
Yes.
Don't spend the time filling salt and pepper shakers.
Mm-hmm.
Fill the time filling their brain with some of the ideas
mm-hmm.
of how they can effectively sell to their customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, the bulk benefit, they all benefit, the customer, the server, and the owner, when there is upsells, when they get a better service, when they can sell a little more. Everybody benefits.
Well, that's true, but the problem is, the point I'm making is that I think a high percentage of people in the service environment are just as happy showing up because
mm-hmm.
they make so much money
mm-hmm.
just automatically.
Right.
I mean, you know, I'll never forget Patty Carver in my dining room saying to me, well, you know, I make 75
mm-hmm.
no matter what I do.
Mm-hmm.
If I try harder, I may make 80, 85, 90. And I'm thinking, well, wouldn't you like to have that extra $15? And she basically said, yeah, but I'm doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to just put that in context, that maybe to a lot of these people who do not see this as a career, that just showing up is perfectly adequate, and if we let them just show up, we're going to get what we always got.
But when you do that pre-shift thing, though, Bill, and you're doing that every single day, how do you keep that from getting so old after time? If you don't have any turnover in your staff?
Well, if you want to continue to grow your brand, your restaurant's brand, you all know that you've got to each visit have some tiny little bit of innovation, something new, something different, a little bit each single time. And something different might be a table visit by a manager. But the point is, you got to keep making that experience a little fresher each time that customer comes in. Otherwise, they're going to go someplace else.
I think what he means is keeping it fresh for the staff.
Absolutely.
And you're really speaking to the soul here of what we struggle with here. I've got two managers sitting here listening to you, too, and I think they're both nodding their heads in agreement that you that we're devoted to this whole pre-shift huddle and trying to do exactly what you said, wake them up before the shift and just try to get them motivated to make $110 instead of $100, like you illustrated so perfectly. They just don't have the motivation. It's like, it's $10, you know.
Well, one strategy that is a very foundational in that respect is to put the burden on them in the pre-shift briefing to provide you, and I think Bill Marmon does a great job on this, what have we learned from our staff lately, is let them share their trade secrets, if you will, and just saying to a waiter or waitress, tell me how you sell dessert. And selecting people that have particular proclivities, if you will. One girl is really good at selling wine. Another guy is really good at selling desserts. you know, let them be the trainer. Draw out from them their opinions, their successes.
Well, it carries a lot more weight.
No question. And what it does is it, you get the byproduct, which is what you're really looking for, is self-esteem and respect. And that's something this generation really needs, Generation Y really needs to feel. They're included, they're respected, because, again, so much of life when you're 21 years old is people telling you what to do and not do. And I think the restaurateurs, by and large, use that kind of an approach. Here's what you need to know today, boom, 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 not what can you recommend or what have you done that's been successful, can you share it with the group, not unlike what we're doing here today.
Can I ask a question that totally is off, not what we're talking about?
Sure.
Wanted to sell a couple of restaurants. How do you go about doing that?
Selling a restaurant?
Yeah. Besides the business brokers, classified ads, so forth, so on. You know.
Well, the first, you know, Edmund, there's a lot of variables here, and this is a more extended conversation, but off the top...
Mm-hmm. Mom and pop place.
Off the top, the first place you got to go is you got to put together a package that's got some sex appeal to it. Can't just be, here's the financial statement, number one. Number two, I have found in selling mom-and-pop restaurants that 90% of the time they're sold to people that are right in my neighborhood, that already know them. So I would start with a business broker and or commercial real estate person who's done restaurants, has a certain reputation for it, or makes it part of what they do, and find somebody very, very local. I mean, someone that hopefully patronizes the place. Because individual restaurants really have no market outside of their neighborhood.
Particularly small ones.
Yeah. That's not totally true, but you know, there's always going to be the people that are going to come to town and, you know, going to say others. But you want to make selling a restaurant an inside deal, not an outside deal, meaning that advertising and the conventional ways that you create exposure and awareness don't necessarily work, usually don't work, because it turns the restaurant into a commodity. Second of all, you got to make sure that your lease is a solid lease. More restaurant deals fall apart because people didn't read the fine print on the lease. And you got to make sure that that component of it is handled up front. It saves you a lot of time. Some leases can't be assigned. Some leases you got to stay on with personal guarantees. Edmund, you know where I'm going here. Start with the only thing that really has any value in a restaurant, which is your lease. Make sure that that lease is market, fair, and equitable, and make sure that the landlord is open to an assignment. And then I'd say the third thing is...
And renegotiate a term if you need to before you start to take it out to sell it.
Exactly. And it
usually make sure there's enough
little.
Because you need enough time for people to get their money back.
Exactly right. And I'd say the third thing is be open to a management contract.
Right.
Which is essentially to say, and front load this into the offering, we will continue to operate this restaurant for 1 year at your pleasure, obviously. We're going to teach you, but we're going to stick with it. We're not just going to pack up one day and leave you. That creates an environment of partnership, which builds the integrity of the transaction.
And if you cared about your staff, it would keep things smooth transition.
Excellent point. Exactly right.
And don't take back paper.
Don't take bad paper.
Well, because if you take back, I mean, what I mean by that is if you take back part of a note on this thing, your ability to get paid becomes a function of their ability to operate profitably. If they are not operating profitably, you might find yourself back in there working as hard or harder.
Right. Just so they can make mom and pop places with mom and pop people, they haven't got the money to give you all cash anyway.
Well,
well, this is true.
Yeah, nor the background to go, you know, get the SBA to support them.
This is true. And this is why, as you correctly point out, this is one of the hardest areas to extract value from an individual restaurant. If you work for 5 or 6 years and you realize, or even 10, you realize, my goodness, I don't really have any value here.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me all the time, you know, what's my restaurant worth? And I always have the same answer. Nothing. That tends to be a showstopper. But the fact of the matter is that the only value a restaurant has is in its ability to generate continued sales and earnings in the future. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of equipment and a lease and an obligation that is worth 10 cents on the dollar, by and large. So that's why I love the management contract approach. And it's for Peter's point as far as staff is crucial as well. And a lot of times I would take, I have actually done one where I said, your note, I had to carry a note, your note has no interest for the first year while the management contract's in place. In other words, I'll carry the paper for a year at no cost to you just to show my commitment to helping you be successful. Now, you got to be very careful who you sell to here.
Right. But when you're under that management contract, but you were still getting paid.
You're getting paid, and in theory, the difference between what you're getting paid and what profits you've been able to demonstrate up till that point is return on their cash investment.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, this is the most, you know, dysfunctional business model there is. I mean, there's so many unknowns. But where I always get concerned in selling mom and pop restaurants is that if the people that are buying them most of the time, not all, but most of the time, are inexperienced in the industry. I've got the dream, you know. And boy, those are the people that you've got to build the time into to help educate them. Which comes back to rapport. You've got to feel at the gut level, Edmund, that whoever's buying it can make a success of it. And sometimes that means not selling it or taking all cash, which is substantially less in theory than it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
But you're really betting that the person that buys it from you can continue and be successful, or you don't get paid.
Yeah, or take the cash and take the paper back, but just have in your mind that the cash is all you're going to get.
Well, I don't like to do that because, again, that doesn't help you long term.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to make a business decision, obviously, but you know, it's. If you're going to go that route, then you got to make it very clear up front. This is an as-is deal. It's like buying a car, as-is. This thing blows up in 1 mile, you're out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm such a great believer in maintaining facilities and having preventive maintenance programs. And because selling a restaurant to someone, a mom-and-pop restaurant, is a lot of it is curb appeal, just like a house. And they don't know the inner workings of it. They don't understand what you've done to make it successful. And it's realistically, you got to be, in one case we did, we actually worked Friday and Saturday nights for the next year on the floor because we wanted the customers that had come there on a regular basis to see us. Well, we understand you sold, yeah, but, you know, you can't get me out of here. I've been here a long time. I really love it. We want to help Joe and Sylvia, you know, be successful, blah, blah, blah. Reassurances. And that's part of the price you pay, Edmund, for being in this stupid business. Don't quote me.
Interesting. What else do we have for Brother Maine while we have him? Because we're...
But Bill, can you give us any gems on back of the house and trying to get them on board, trying to implement the kinds of things we've discussed here? You know, getting servers hyped up is all well and good, but quite honestly, we've focused so much energy on our front of the house over the years that all it does is build resentment in the back of the house, and it's tough to incorporate them into the whole thing.
Here's my gem, cross-evaluations.
Cross-evaluations?
Yes, sir. Here's what I mean. I want to ask the servers, the front of the house people, to evaluate the back of the house people based on their criteria, not yours. In other words, if you ask the average waiter or waitress what drives you crazy about the line cooks, they're going to give you chapter and verse, aren't they?
Yep.
If you ask the line cooks what drives you nuts about the waiters and waitresses, do you think they'd have an opinion?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you capture, and Peter, there's a trade secret on this called cross-evaluations. You put together a somewhat informal evaluation template, and you pick the questions that are the ones that are top of mind for the service staff. You pick the questions that are top of mind for the back-of-the-house staff. Then you ask the back-of-the-house staff to do an evaluation on the front-of-the-house individuals, and you ask the front-of-the-house people to do an evaluation on the back-of-the-house people, because, again, you're speaking in their language as they see their world, okay? Whoever is the best back-of-the-house person, as judged by the servers, like the People's Choice Awards and the Academy Awards, for movies. I mean, I always love the People's Choice Awards because the People's Choice Awards are customer centered, aren't they? And so if enough average guys like me say this movie's a great movie, it's probably a great movie. But if the critics tell me that, I don't necessarily believe it, because the critic may be being paid big money to promote it. Same type of environment exists in a restaurant. What we're talking about here is evaluating behaviors and how people work in the work environment on the basis of their peers, not on the basis of your criteria. And the way we used to do it was we would do it once a year. It takes some work. I'll tell you right now, it takes some work. But whoever was the best, and I'm going to restrict this to line cooks for a second, whoever is the best line cook as evaluated by the waiters and waitresses based on their criteria, became the line cook of the year and got a $500 bonus.
Wow.
Whoever is the best waiter or waitress, as judged by the line cooks, got a $500 bonus. And 1 year, we gave them $1,000 each. Now, what kind of a statement is that from you as a manager or an owner about the kinds of behaviors you want to model?
Yep. Makes sense.
And
you
so
$100 would work, I bet.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. But you got to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
You got to have a trophy. You got to have a party. You got to, and you got to, and this is the thing I would tell you more than anything else. Don't shortchange the bonus.
Yeah.
In for penny, in for pound.
Yeah.
If you say, well, it's $25, it isn't going to mean anything to them. What you got to do is put some money on the line. Invest some real money in changing behaviors, particularly if you have problems in this area. And it becomes the biggest deal. Now, guess what happens once you've got the line cook of the year and the waiter waitress of the year, and they've each got $1,000? Guess what happens on the next hire you have in the kitchen? Guess who the role model in the kitchen becomes to that new person just being oriented? Who's the role model? The person that is modeling the behaviors that you want to see. Same in the front of the house. Yeah,
makes sense. Makes sense. It's funny, I see it here on your site. Oh, wait. I hadn't seen it.
Yep. That's a gem. That works.
Yep.
That works. But I will tell you right now, put some money into it and be patient and deliberate in building it. The only way you can build the questions is you got to talk to the people. You got to go into quasi-focus group mode, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Bring in somebody outside. Don't you do it. put your waiters and waitresses room, get a professor from the school in marketing or somebody you know and trust and say, close the doors and say, we want this to be a bitch session. And the subject is, what do the line cooks do that drive you nuts? Build 10 questions. Do a 1 to 5 rating. Do the same at the back of the house. Now, the back of the house interface is somewhat more difficult, obviously, in because beyond line cooks, you know, what do the prep people do and what are the dishwashers, blah, 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 blah. But in quick service, if you're in any kind of quick service, it works very well because you've got the counter people and then you've got the people behind the counter people, and usually that's two groups. There's a certain interchangeability. But if you just did it with line cooks and waiters and waitresses in your first pass, you're going to create an event within your company, within your restaurant, that these people are going to go crazy over. And if you make the announcement, we used to do it, and we used to build it up so that the announcement, we just had these people at the edge of their seats. And when one guy gets it, everybody's up their feet, they're yelling, and they're screaming, and they're clapping, and everybody's thrilled, and blah, blah, blah. It's a big deal.
Now, in theory, it sounds great, but what happens if, for instance, they decide to elect somebody who is, or choose someone based on their criteria, somebody who isn't exactly what you would call a model of productivity, or somebody who's good but not great, and you really are sort of discouraged that his behavior will be totally...
Somebody's buying beer for everybody at the end of the night.
Yeah, could be.
Well, here's the answer. The answer to that is, if, in fact, somebody gets that award based on the criteria they've written, and that individual is not who you perceive deserves that award, you now know, don't you, where the disconnect exists between what you think and reward and what they do. And isn't that the most powerful information you could ever get?
Well, that's true. Then what do you do, though?
Well... then you've got to look at what the gap is, what the variance between what your expectations are and what they want, and you got to examine it. And typically that examination brings out some painful realities. There's guys that have been there for 9 years that you should fire that, you know, have a certain attitude, but they're really valuable because they do it well and they can turn 15 tickets in 15 minutes and, you know, all those criteria. But you got to know those things.
Well, and it's not a public vote, so it's not like everybody knows that so-and-so got more votes than somebody else.
Oh, you mean it's like dump the barrel with the spoon in your back pocket?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's right. And again, you know, have you ever, Peter, been to a customer focus group with a two-way glass?
I have not, but I've read something about them.
It ought to be a criteria that everybody, before they get the restaurant business, participates in one of these. Because I've been behind the two-way mirrors, and I've watched customers answer questions that are posed by facilitators. And I've watched employees of restaurants and owners of restaurants listen to those customers and just about have heart failure.
Yeah.
Screaming out, but that's not right!
Really?
But the reality is, Peter, it's their perception. And that perception is defining their purchasing behavior, isn't it? So it doesn't really matter what you think, Peter.
Doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong either.
Exactly. Because for you, you want to control the purchasing behaviors, don't you?
Yeah.
And so whatever the painful truth is, you got to get to it one way or another. And this is an ideal way to start. It's not perfect and it's not fun. And you're going to find there's going to be components of it that are not going to be easy to resolve. But the point is, you're sending a message to your service staff, you're sending a message to your back-of-the-house team, that their opinions and their view of the world has value to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first step to building hospitality.
I might go at it slightly differently, only because I'd rather dwell on positives instead of things that drive you nuts. I mean, another way to approach it would be to say, you know, what are the, again, talk to the back of the house and say, what are all the qualities that servers need to have in order to, you know, have this thing work extremely well for you? and talk to the servers and say what things have to be happening in the kitchen in order for this to work well for you, and it may fall off into several different areas. And then you say who is the best, the most exemplary in each of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of build it up from the pieces, because not everybody's going to be strong in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody may end up with the most points overall, but they can use some work in this area. And it also gives you some information for you know, for performance appraisals and coaching and whatever after the fact, but it keeps it working more from the positive instead of saying, who really drives you nuts.
Yep, great point.
Yeah. Great guys, point. I got to go.
Well, I think we're about it.
I want to say goodbye. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Okay. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Edmund.
All right, bye-bye, guys.
Well, we're about at that time. I told Bill I'd only steal an hour of his day, and we've already taken a little bit more of that. We will have more chance to chat at the Super Summit, and thanks for your note on that managers forum, by the way, Peter.
Yeah, I heard you all to check that out. It's growing, and I've been impressed.
That's great.
I don't know if you got it or not, Bill. I sent one to you too as well, Bill Main.
Oh, really? Good. Okay.
An email to a link, a site that a restaurant manager named David Main or Mann has started. It's really just a forum, and it. He's fans of all yours and has mentioned you on occasion.
Great. Well, I appreciate that follow-up, and it's been a pleasure talking to all of you.
Thank you.
And
terrific.
Mr. Marvin, always a pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. We will chat again soon.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you all.